Welcome to Retrospective Radio. This is Jason Mann, and with me is the delightful Josh Hatchett. How you doing, Josh?
I'm doing great. I'm doing much better after I get called delightful, so thanks for that, Jason.
Hey, no problem. No problem. And we've got quite a show for our listeners today. Another popular question and answer show by popular demand.
It's fun.
Yeah. So, first question that we are going to deal with is angles that died without there being a conclusion. And so we're just going to talk about a few that we remember and what we thought of those. First is the infamous WCW Hummer Driver. And if you were not watching WCW and don't know what this is, basically the gist of it was June 1999. Kevin Nash was champion, and he was feuding with Randy Savage. And someone tried to run Kevin Nash over with a Hummer. And it was insinuated that it was a buddy of Savage's. And then Sid later debuted as Savage's buddy. And there was some belief at the time that it was Sid. But a few months later, Lex Luger tried to, when Nash was feuding with Hogan after Nash had turned heel, Luger tried to insinuate that Hogan was actually the one who tried to run over Nash. And then it was later revealed that Lex Luger was a liar, and that it was he in fact did not know who it was. And the matter was basically completely dropped until April of 2000, when Eric Bischoff and Vince Russo had their first WCW Nitro together, and they did a bunch of weird stuff. And one of the things that they did was they had Eric Bischoff try to kill Hulk Hogan with a Hummer. And that was supposed to lead you to believe that Bischoff was the one responsible, apparently. The funny thing is that the Hummer kept changing colors. It went from black to white like it was a Michael Jackson song. So I don't think anyone really had a good plan there. It was just kind of, it was just something to do. You know, before we answer this question, it brings me up to another one. Why was there so much vehicle-related violence, particularly in WCW?
Wow, that's a good question.
They always had to have like a car involved, or and WWE they did this, you know, a decent amount too. But it seems like WCW was they were just big car fans, and they felt like they needed to get them involved, but. I don't know, pretty much every car-related storyline, you know, angle, what have you, that I've seen ends up being pretty stupid. I mean, I guess it's, kind of cool when Austin would make his entrances in the truck, but it's not like, he never hit anyone with them. He just like, okay, it's a cool way to make an entrance. Other than spraying beer out of the truck, never really, got involved, in other storyline, in other things, it's like, when you try and hit somebody with a vehicle, it's just like, I don't know. I think it's just way too unrealistic.
Yeah, it comes off, if you're using the actual vehicle to, like, harm someone, it looks really stupid, unless it's, Mick Foley taking a rock bottom on the hood of a car.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's obviously different because you're using the car as a prop, but you're still, like, it's like the physical action of the wrestlers.
Yeah, but doing an injury angle with a car, or we saw the Bret Hart thing was just the whole execution of that was really stupid, and like you said, the whole Hummer stuff with WCW was just awful. Pretty much the only ones that really had success with that was Austin, and like you said, he wasn't actually using it on people. He used the monster truck to drive over Rock's car. He filled up Vince McMahon's car with cement or, whatever. But
yeah.
He wasn't actually using it on someone. But, you'd think by now that they'd realize that that's not an effective way to do a feud.
Yeah, I don't remember the last vehicle related thing they've done. I guess when McMahon, you know, when he was in the car and it blew up.
That was really dumb too.
Yeah, you know, at least he was in there and you could see it explode. I mean, as dumb of a storyline, at least you like saw like that happen. I don't know. That didn't really make it any better. Never mind. I'm taking that back. Those are always bad. So, anyway, back to the angles that did not have a conclusion. Famous one would be involving Austin at King of the Ring 99, which was around the same time as the Hummer driver, when he was in a ladder match against Shane and Vince McMahon for control of WWE, and the briefcase was he was going to it was I don't know if it was a briefcase or if it was a contract or something. Anyway, the ended up being when Austin was going up, it ended up being raised in the air so he could not reach it. And they kind of built that, you know, it was a mystery person, and then it was pretty strongly implied that it was the Big Boss Man, but they never actually, you know, said it was the Big Boss Man.
Yeah, that one I remember that, and it just kind of fizzled out, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's even worse about something like that is you kind of invest in the pay-per-view, watch the pay-per-view, and then it almost turns out, you know, well, that pay-per-view is a waste of time because nothing really ever even came from it. So it's like, you know, in a sense, you look back at it and it's like, you know, that pay-per-view is a complete waste of time and money in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple other ones that were mentioned, would have been GTV, the Gold Dust. It was sort of like grainy, like security camera type footage that had like a GTV logo on it. In fact, I think it might have even been like GDTV at first, and then it would change to GTV. It was strongly implied that it was Gold Dust who was behind it, but then Gold Dust ended up getting fired from WWF. This was also in 99. Apparently 99 was the year of unresolved angles.
They just threw so much out at you that, you know, some of it just went away.
Yeah. And, and then they had, you know, they kind of had like, I mean, those segments lasted quite a while. I mean, they may have even lasted like in the 2000 where basically they'd have like, they'd just have random like segments where they'd suddenly like on the screen would appear like security camera type footage, and usually it would reveal like, you know, heels plotting or somebody cheating on somebody, or, you know, it would reveal behavior that would embarrass whoever was in the ring. It was basically just kind of a cheap storytelling device that they used.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Why do you think this went away? Did they just, you know, they couldn't fit it with someone and so they just dropped it, or
I mean, yeah, nothing else really makes sense, or they just, you would think, I don't know, you would think if you would bring something up, unless there's a really good reason not to resolve it, then, you know, why just not resolve it? I don't know. I don't understand that mentality. I mean, even if it's a stupid storyline, you might as well come up with a conclusion and then move on rather than just, you know, completely dropping it.
Yeah, because that just kind of admits that it was dumb, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Just drop it completely.
Yeah. We actually won like that this year even was the Samoa Joe storyline.
Yeah, yeah.
We still don't know who kidnapped Samoa Joe.
Maybe he just faked it.
I guess it's possible, but you know, maybe they could tell us that. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess
so. Yeah.
TNA, I bet if we thought about it and kind of studied the past couple, 3 years, we could probably have a whole show of things that they failed to finish.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure there are definitely. Definitely are. Let's see. Some other ones. Kind of looking at a few lists here. There was a storyline also in '99 of Raven who kind of went. They had some vignettes where he and Canyon went to where Raven grew up, and it turns out that Raven was a spoiled rich kid who had grown up with a lot of money and, you know, in support of parents or whatever. You know, he kind of gave you the idea that he was a, you know, that he was a guy who had been mistreated, but in fact he was completely you know, had a well adjusted childhood and was well liked. So but yeah, I don't know if that was necessarily really a dropped one, but it was more of like, well, they showed it and then they really didn't do much with it. They just kind of had him come back, and actually he turned babyface right after that. So that was kind of weird, but yeah, WCW storylines in 99 were pretty wacky.
Yes, that'd be nice. A nice way of putting it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. If, you know, there's storylines. Obviously, there's storylines that like are not resolved, and there's also storylines that the resolution is just completely like insanely dumb. Like, for instance, I can think of three off the top of my head. The Higher Power storyline. Where, you know, it ended up being Vince McMahon in the end who was behind, like, all these, you know, all these machinations, like, including the kidnapping of his daughter and, like, things that there was absolutely, like, no possible, like, motivation he could have had to do all these things.
That was one of the worst payoffs that I can remember of my, you know, wrestling viewing.
Yeah. They at least did the thing where they had, like, you know, they gave Austin control of the company, and he became the CEO because, you know, Vince had done these things. So that at least was, like, a surprise that, you know, that came from that people didn't know was coming when everyone, like, was dreading that it would be Vince. And, like, you know, no one knew for sure, but, like, Vince was just, like, the most likely candidate, even though it didn't make sense, just because, like, you know, the guy who you would position as like the mastermind behind everything would be Vince. So like it made complete sense, even though it didn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
then Austin, when he was attacked at Survivor Series 99 in another vehicle related attack. And then a year later, he came back and was trying to solve the mystery of who would be, who would have been his attacker. And kind of the guy who really sort of made some sense was Jericho, who had just kind of debuted and was a heel, and you know, would have been a really good way to put him in the mix. Or I'm sorry, actually it was 2000. So he had not just come in; he'd been there for a year. He was actually babyface, but he could have turned heel, and it would have been pretty great if it had been Jericho. But ended up being Rikishi of all people, who was not even wrestling the year before, at least not on television. And then a couple weeks after that, you learn that it was Triple H was the mastermind behind it all along, which. Which also was bad because Triple H was in a storyline that it made completely perfect sense for him to turn babyface, and in fact he'd already sort of turned babyface, and having him go back as a heel just I don't know, screwed with the fans too much, I think.
Yeah.
Although he and Austin actually had a decent feud, including a classic match at No Way Out 01. So you know you got that out of it at least.
Yeah.
So
what was the third one?
You know what? I forget. I just I don't have a resolution to that question. I dropped the storyline. So
okay, well, you dropped it, right?
Yeah. So I'm.
I think you planned that.
Did I? I don't know. You know. Well, whatever answer I would have had would have been disappointing anyway. So
I'll say like the ones. You know, just some of the goofy ones with, you know, the payoff with like, whether it be like a strip tease or something, you know, corny and silly like that, or even, you know, Edge and Lita or something like that, where you know, they're going to do this on live TV, you know, in the bed in the ring. You know, the payoff, you just kind of know that it's just, you know, I don't even, I'm not even sure why they even go there, because you know the payoff's going to be silly, or even the Mae Young giving birth one or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, just stuff like that where you know it's going to be silly before they even do it, and obviously you're right every time. So.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that it's unfortunate when that sort of thing happens, but What can you do?
Yeah.
No other. I guess the one of the really famous. Well, there's two other ones that are pretty famous. One was Diamond Dallas Page. In '96, he'd had a feud with the Booty Man, also known as Brutus Beefcake, and he had lost Kimberly, the Diamond Doll, and he'd also lost like his fortune, which is like $6 million or some absurd number. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, a mysterious benefactor came to support him and give him money, and then he came back and started wrestling again. And actually won the very last Battle Bowl. And they were kind of building that it was a mysterious benefactor, and then they decided just completely dropped it and did nothing else. So which actually the one guy who would have made a lot of sense would have been Ted DiBiase, who debuted in WCW not around the same time, a little bit after, a few months afterward, I guess. Of course, DiBiase got involved with the NWO, so that it would have been hard to tie that in together since Paige wasn't in the NWO and, in fact, turned babyface and feud with the NWO. And the other one would be Baby Doll's photos in envelope. This is a little. I wasn't watching NWA WCW at the time, so the details of this I don't want to get wrong, but I. But I believe it was Larry Zbyszko and Baby Doll together were trying to blackmail Dusty Rhodes, and there were photos in this envelope, and we were led to believe that it would be revealed what they were, but in fact it never was revealed what they were. So sadly, the world does not know.
It was very sad.
Yeah. All right. Well, any other ones you can think of off the top of your head?
I think we hit the major one.
All right. Well, fair enough. Second question is, who in your opinion throws the best punch in wrestling? By the way, before we answer that, I forgot to mention the last question was asked by Jacob Yount. So, and this question here is. Pizza Body Slam, our good friends at Pizza Body Slam, Slam great wrestling blog. If you, you should all listeners should check it out. And his question: who, in your opinion, throws the best punch in wrestling, past or present or both or apocalyptic future? I have a hard tough time pronouncing apocalyptic. So,
Yeah, that's okay.
all right, I stumbled over that one well enough. Let's go ahead. Who throws? Who are some of the best punchers?
Well, and I'm not, this is just my opinion, but I always enjoyed The Rock's punches. Even I don't know if they were the most realistic looking or what have you, but they looked fairly athletic, and he always, he'd spit into his hand and then punch again and stuff like that. And I always enjoyed his punching capability. So,
Okay. All right.
what about you? You
Well,
have
Jerry Lawler famously has some of the best, best punches. Just look really good. Make really good contact. Look like they hurt, and understood like when to throw them and how to throw them, especially when he's making his comebacks. Bret Hart, his and everything he did looked very good and very crisp, and his were good. Austin's punches were always pretty good.
We talked about the big shows, finishing
Yeah,
move, the
his
knockout.
knockout punch that always looks good. I agree.
You said you mentioned Triple H as well.
Yeah, Triple H. Yeah, people. Yeah, his punches are strong, and that's one of the things he does pretty well. Harley Race's punches, they're The guy at Triple H emulates quite a bit. His there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of there really are a lot of great punchers in history. Yeah, I mean, you kind of had to be you had your punches had to look good because it was part of the what you did had to look good or people didn't buy it. you know, 20, 30 years ago. You know, I mean, you know, there are definitely exceptions, and there are definitely places where, you know, if you look at some, like, of the old, like, Sheik matches, I mean, those, you know, did not look like particular fights. So there were places where you could get away with action that didn't look realistic. But for the most part, you know, in you know, the major territories where, you know, real money was being made and it was treated, you know, very seriously like a sport, you know, you had to make it look good.
Especially, you know, a lot of them, you know, a lot of territories really, you know, used a stiff style. So, you know, that was, you know, you kind of had to, you know, rear back and slug someone almost.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I've read about this and or listened to, I guess I've heard podcasts about this, but haven't really seen it. We've heard, you know, we've both heard the St. Louis podcast, and they talk a little bit about, you know, Johnny Valentine, who's Greg the Hammer Valentine's dad, and Greg Valentine also very good with punches, but you know, Johnny Valentine's style was very influential, somewhat in St. Louis, but later when he moved to the Carolinas toward the end of his career, probably 73, 74, and worked. I mean, you know, you can kind of imagine if you know Greg Valentine. Johnny Valentine's style was similar, although possibly like even more physical and more brutal. And he, you know, that style ended up becoming the predominant style in the Crockett territory. And the reason that's important now is because that style is the style that, you know, guys like Flair and Steamboat, when they came around a few years later, started to work. And obviously they put their, you know, they put their own athletic spin on it and, you know, did you know, kind of more action moves too. But, you know, without Johnny Valentine, we may not have had, you know, Ric Flair develop the same. And without Ric Flair developing the same, I mean, think of how many guys Ric Flair influenced.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt about that, yeah.
So if you just, you know, you just kind of think of, like, how, you know, like, one, you know, if Johnny Valentine had never gone to, and then Johnny Valentine was a huge star in his day and was, you know, a huge star in the, you know, 50s and 60s and early 70s, but be kind of forgotten today, but just how, you know, what his influence was on the, you know, obviously on the modern product through, you know, his influencing of the Carolinas style and, you know, and through Flair.
Yeah, great point.
Thanks. I like it occasionally when I can seem smart.
Yes.
So, yeah, those are the guys off the top of my head I can think of. I'm sure there's, you know, dozens of guys, you know, 70s and 80s guys who you could throw in there and who had great punches. You know, yeah, punches has never been, like, one thing. I mean, not that – I mean, I could tell when somebody has terrible punches. Like, you know, Rob Van Dam has pretty bad punches. And yeah. Who are some of the guys who have pretty terrible punches? John Morrison.
I just had a bunch on the top of my head, and they all just totally slipped my mind.
Oh, unfortunate. Well, I mean, yeah, I can tell when somebody has really bad punches, but as far as, like, I don't know, as long as your punches are, like, pretty good, I don't have, like, you know, it's not something I notice as closely as I notice, like, other stuff, you know? I've never really been in a fight myself, so I don't, like, know, like, the best what, like, good punches look like. Or maybe I'm just, like, I'm used to, like, you know, worked punches in wrestling, so I, like, have a more, like, I have a better ability to suspend disbelief when it comes to punches, as long as they, like, make contact and look pretty good. And it depends also a lot on the guy selling the punch, too. I mean, you can throw really good punches, but if the guy who is taking them isn't really selling them, then you know, then you're not really good. A couple guys. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, there's definitely an art to taking a punch too that makes you look better. So
yeah, a couple more that I just thought off the top of my head, of course, are Regal and Finley, and some of the matches they had, particularly in WCW. There's one really, really, really brutal WCW Saturday Night match that they had that is just, you know, incredibly, incredibly physical. And, you know, they're just, you know, they're really wailing on each other. We've obviously seen Regal. I mean, obviously Regal, you know, he works pretty good today. But, you know, we've seen some of his Nitro matches where he really, you know, lays in some punches. You know, he had a really great match with Benoit and a, you know, good match with Eddie Guerrero, you know, where he's, you know, kind of working, you know, working those in. So.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, and those are two more guys that were pretty stiff style, so that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So the next question, which is from On Short Rest, sort of wanting us to talk about the goings-on in TNA over the last week. Jeff Hardy turning heel and joining together with Hulk Hogan, Eric Bischoff, Abyss, and Jeff Jarrett, and forming a new heel faction, NWO-like group. Sort of talking about that and talking about the events of Impact tonight with Hogan's group sort of merging, or at least aligning themselves with Fortune, led by Ric Flair, and the idea of Hogan and Flair being allies, which is not something that we've actually only seen it once very briefly, but let's talk about Jeff Hardy as a heel first.
What was your thoughts on that?
I have to let it play out, but I think if you were going to make a if you're going to pick any professional wrestler to turn heel, Jeff Hardy would be nearly at the bottom of the list based on the kind of skills that a heel needs, you know, particularly in promos, and being able to give a sense of arrogance and I don't think of Jeff Hardy as having much of a personality. I know he's popular, and I know he has a colorful look, and you know, people really like him, and you know, he can definitely draw sympathy, but you know, I think of him as being, you know, fairly like a colorless, bland personality. So it's difficult for me to see how he can, you know, really be a strong promo and do what you need to do. You know, maybe he can change his style to work heel, although he has a very much a high flying babyface style, so that seems like that's going to be a hard sell. And you know, he's really the one guy who's, you know, really pretty genuinely popular in TNA, and you know, just in the last year has been a genuine, you know, huge draw as a babyface in wrestling. You know, granted, he's cooled off in that year quite a bit, but still, you know, he's, you know, a guy who apparently is, you know, pretty big merchandise seller for them. You know, just business, you know, even business wise, from what I know, it seems like a, you know, it does not seem like a good decision. You know, obviously, you know, I mean, you know, maybe it's something that could end up working, but I mean, it just seems like Jeff Hardy is a bad choice. And it seems like, from what I read, the reason they chose him is because he was the last person that people would expect. And that's kind of a reason why he was the last person that people would expect.
You know, and that's, you know, that's just a case of not seeing this, you know, having a long-term plan with this. You know, they come up with, well, you know, well, if we turn Jeff Hardy heel, that would shock everyone the most. Well, that's fine and all, but the problem is, it'll shock you once, but, you know, within a month or, you know, 2 months, it's going to come up as a colossal failure, just because everyone knows it's not going to fit. And, you know, if it was going to work, it wouldn't happen with, you know, the guys that are running TNA. They wouldn't be able to do it. You know, Jeff Hardy might be able to be a heel, but the writing and creative team in TNA is not going to be able to pull it off.
I have no confidence that they could. I mean, miracles do happen. It's, you know, nothing is impossible, but you know, it's highly unlikely.
Yeah, and just because something's going to be a huge shock, I mean, that's fine for one time, but you know, that's no reason to come up with a plan. You know, you may have a one thing where it surprises people, but you know, you got to think about, you know, is this going to work long term, or you know, can he be a top heel for several months? And you know, like you said, I think we know the answer to that.
Probably not. And you know, here's the funny, you know, I wrote a piece earlier this week on on heel turns involving, you know, top baby faces who have, you know, really never been heels. Like Jeff had a very, very brief heel run in early days of the Hardy Boys, you know, when he joined up with Gangrel and they were briefly the New Brood, but basically he's never been a heel. And, you know, looking at the first Sting heel turn in 99 in WCW and the Goldberg heel turn in June of 2000, you know, both of those were, you know, kind of designed to be huge shock moments, kind of game changers that were supposed to turn the company around, and neither worked at all. Both guys ended up really turning back very quickly because no one wanted to see their guy as a heel. And, you know, the Goldberg one was particularly stupid. The Sting one, you know, I think was worth the effort, you know, because, you know, it was something different and it kind of led to some interesting things. Sting didn't really seem to have his heart in it, and that's, you know, and you know, they were, the company was having struggles at the time. So, I mean, that at least was an honest effort, and it's like, well, you know, it didn't work, that's fine. But, you know, then they tried it again. They also did it with Bret Hart, you know, trying to reform the NWO for the umpteenth time in December 99, kind of in between those other two. And it was just, you know, it's like, okay, you build up, try to do this big surprise, and you keep, you know, doing the same thing, and, you know, no one's really that surprised. And, you know, now I think people were surprised that Jeff turned. Now, no one was surprised that Hogan and Bischoff ended up being they. I mean, that was a completely predictable thing that, you know, we'd even talked about before on previous podcasts. So, you know, everyone kind of knew that was coming. And I don't know. Yeah, you know, people, yeah, I mean, you know, a good surprise can work every once in a while, but, you know, you don't build your company around that. I mean, that's like a, you know, that's like almost like a bonus, you know, and, you know, that's obviously, yeah, I mean, that's like almost like, that's like, you know, you create like a good product and then you have like surprises every once in a while. You don't expect like the surprises to like drive your product. I don't know. I mean, yeah. Obviously, you know, there was the big Hogan heel turn in 96, which obviously was a big deal for WCW and led to them growing, and, you know, that heel faction, you know, and, you know, the NWO obviously led to them having their biggest run of success ever. And, you know, Hogan's shock heel turn was a big part of that, but, you know, that was one time and, a very specific, unique circumstances. And, you know, and, you know, people were ready for Hogan to turn, and, you know, he was being booed by more crowds than being cheered. And, you know, you just can't expect to, you know, wrestling was completely different, then you just can't expect to rekindle that.
No, you can't, you know, but, you know, in TNA, they keep thinking, you know, we can repeat the past, but, you know, the only past that they're repeating is the failures of WCW.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing a good job with that. But
yeah, there's no, like, yeah, it's funny because there's, like, no discerning, like, what worked and what didn't work. It's like, well, you know, we did it before, so let's do it again. People will, like, remember that, but, so, yeah, I don't know. Weird stuff.
Yeah. And you mentioned Sting, you know, that WCW tried to do it, and obviously it didn't work out. Yet TNA tries it, you know, 10 years later, and somehow we're expecting it to work. So that should be, like, all you need to know about, you know, how well this is going to turn out.
Yeah, they tried it twice, actually. They did it with the Main Event Mafia, and they did it again I think it was the first, it was the early March show, the one where, you know, they were permanently moving to Monday nights, and it lasted, what, 6-8 weeks, something like that, maybe not even that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, well, talking about, I guess, the sort of the Hogan group merging with, or not really merging, but I guess aligning with the Flair group, which also ties into a second question we had, which I'll just go ahead and read right now. It's by S. Allen 87, and with two large heel factions in TNA, how will they coexist together? How do you think that, I think, you know, there have definitely been times where there have been, you know, two heel groups, you know, that sort of, either kind of work together or kind of, just kind of stay out of each other's way. I mean, I can think of the Four Horsemen, in those days. I mean, there would be groups like, the Varsity Club in particular. There would be secondary heel groups there. Obviously, we've been watching the early WCW Nitros, and they've been, there have been the Dungeon of Doom and the Horsemen. All that's an example of groups really not coexisting. So,
yeah.
I think it would be really, really bad to have those groups like merge together. But as far as, like having one, kind of do their thing and feud with certain baby faces and having the other kind of be more in the mid card right now, I mean, I don't think there's necessarily a problem with that. I mean, you could have, you could do tag matches where you have, AJ and Jeff, tagging together, although both of those guys are not good heels and better baby faces, but just, accepting that, just having them, be your two guys, and they occasionally will, they will, occasionally do things together maybe, but not like have like when the NWO, had 20 guys in it and, and 15 of them were useless. You don't want that. So.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be cool to have two heel factions if they just kind of were total opposites in kind of how they had success and how they won. And, maybe one was just purely devious and the other one was just a strong heel group that was just a nasty, mean group or whatever. But, I think if they kind of went their separate ways and were kind of, had characteristics that made them completely different, yet still heels, I think that'd be pretty cool, actually. But, like you said, it doesn't seem like that's happening.
Yeah, no, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, if you have like different types of groups, I think that definitely works much better. So, yeah, I mean, I think it can work. I don't think it's necessarily like, I don't know. I'm not. I mean, the Fortune group is okay. I mean, I like Doug Williams pretty well. I like his personality and his matches seem pretty okay. I really don't think much of Matt Morgan.
No.
Particularly his selling is really, really bad.
Yeah.
Like and he tries to, sell a move, but he looks incredibly goofy and dumb and I'm not a fan of his at all. Let's see. Kazarian, I don't know, he doesn't do anything for me really. I don't know, his look also, he looks like, he looks kind of old, and he's kind of playing like a, I don't know, like a young, like, sort of meant to be like a, I don't know, a sexy guy, for lack of a better term, like, like a, a young kind of, swinger stud type deal. There's a word that I'm looking for that I can't remember, but it's okay. But he doesn't seem like he looks that part. I don't know.
I agree with that.
Although I thought him and Styles kind of had decent chemistry. Like they'd make a really good, heel tag team, I think. Or at least, personality wise, maybe not so much work wise, but, like I said, better off as baby faces. There's six guys, right? Who am I forgetting? Obviously there's Flair, but I thought there was another wrestler.
Money. There's Beer Money.
Oh yeah. Beer
too,
Money.
Right?
Yeah. Beer Money. They're fine. They're obviously good. I'm not, they're fine where they are. I actually think that, you could even do a little more with them, but, a little tangent. It's funny how, Beer Money and Machine Guns had those, had all those really great matches, at least well received matches. And then, 2 months later or whatever, they're basically in completely the same position that they were before, if not like lower on the card than they were before. It's sort of like, well, you had all those great matches and it's like they didn't accomplish anything.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just great matches to have great matches, which, I don't mind having great matches, but it's like, I don't know. I feel like you have part of the reason you have like a series of matches like that is to get both teams over. And like move them up into like another level.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem like, the Guns are, they're wrestling, the Bucks or whatever, and that's fine, but it's like, well, that's, they're just doing the same thing they were doing before. And, you know, I mean, they're part of this, Beer Money's part of this faction, but they're not really working main events or anything like that, or they're not really getting, you know, mic time or anything like that. I mean, they have flair for that. You know, it's just like, I don't know. It just doesn't feel like the best use for them.
No, not at all. Is that their fault or TNA's fault, you think?
No, I mean, I think it's TNA's fault for booking them like that. I mean, I think, you know, in particular, Beer Money could really be like a, you know, could be a main event act, and, you know, could be guys who could, you know, matter in TNA. I mean, nothing's going to draw right away in TNA. You got to completely rebuild everything in order to do that. But, you know, as far as, you know, seeming like, you know, blowing on top, I think they definitely could. Yeah.
Well, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. So, one last question, related to this, we talked about Hogan and Flair being on the same side and aligning with each other. And some people think, well, I guess the criticisms were Hogan and Flair should never be on the same side, which I kind of disagree with. And the other is that Hogan and Flair should not have aligned themselves so quickly, that they should have, you know, like, you know, spent some time, you know, like developing the, you know, like, you know, there's going to be friction between them now, what's going to happen, and then like let it resolve, like, you know, build it up a little bit and then let it resolve, and they can be friends at that point, but you shouldn't just, you know, do that right away.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, there've been a couple times where Hogan and Flair have been on the same side. In particular, there was in '99, which we talked about a little bit earlier, when Sting turned on Hogan. Hogan and Flair sort of feuded with Sting and Luger. I think they even had a Nitro match together, which was pretty good. I think it might have been a six man with Brett, and I forget who else was with the heels, but. You know, that was kind of an interesting, that's kind of the first time they'd ever sort of been on the same side together. And I kind of like the idea of like the old rivals, you know, kind of, you know, putting aside their differences and like, you know, having a common enemy and then, you know, kind of, you know, basically, you know, fighting alongside each other. It's kind of like, you know, the movie LA Confidential, where the, you know, the two guys are feuding basically throughout the, you know, 3/4 of the movie, and then suddenly they realize they have a common enemy, and, you know, and then, you know, decide to fight together.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point, you know, but that would take, you know, planning and slowly building.
Right. Well, I mean, that's not going to work today, because Hogan and Flair can't, you know, they just can't do that anymore. I mean, they can, you know, they can't wrestle anymore. You know, maybe you could do it for one match in a very, very specific, you know, context, but you couldn't, you know, it couldn't be a regular thing. They were also on the same side for a while in the Millionaires Club angle in 2000, the Bischoff and Russo thing, where basically the entire promotion became heels except for the main event guys, who were, you know, the Sting and Luger and Nash and those guys. So, which was not a great storyline, and they didn't really do much with that either. But yeah, I thought the Hogan, of the Hogan Flair thing, you know, really had some potential, but then they brought in Vince Russo and then they completely changed everything. And actually Hogan and Flair were pretty much written out right away. So.
Yep. They sure were.
Yeah. So, all right, and any other thoughts on the Hogan-Flair dynamic?
Well, you know, like I said, I just think, you know, in a sense, you know, especially today, you don't really have any cool heel factions in WWE, none that come to the top of my head. I guess Nexus, but, you know, I'm talking, you know, I guess established guys and
right.
You know, established.
Yeah. They had Straight Edge Society for a bit, but obviously that didn't last. That's done now, and that didn't really last that long. So
yeah, I mean, it'd be kind of cool just to, you know, not like dueling heel factions, but just different ways that they went about their business to be heels. And
yeah, I think it's good to have, you know, a group here or there. You know, because obviously different combinations of guys can kind of bring, you know, different things out of people. But on the other hand, you don't want too many groups together, you know, at the same
Definitely
time.
Not.
I mean, two is your max. I don't think you can really do, you know, any more than two groups at once. And yeah, and they kind of have to, yeah, obviously they have to be, you know, doing different things. And, you know, so, you know, maybe you can have like more like loose alliances where like, you know, you have a manager who manages, you know, five or six guys and they occasionally, you know, team together, or whatever, like, you know, kind of like the, you know, the Bobby Heenan family or that, you know, that sort of thing. You know, back in the '80s, obviously they had, you know, four or five managers in WWF and they all had, you know, they all had the different guys and that was fine, you know, but yeah, you don't want too many, you don't want too many groups or else they mean less.
Yeah. And you also just, it takes up too many people on the roster too, man. You know, you have, you know, 10 guys in this feud and you've got nothing left for other ones.
That's true. Although TNA is such a giant roster that, you know, they,
that's true.
Yeah, they can probably put like everybody into a group and still have plenty of, you know, plenty of spare, time for fit stuff in.
Yep.
So last question, also involving TNA, is about the X Division. Why do we think it's been shunned in TNA, and how can it be saved? And the question is by Graham Williams.
Now, when the X Division was doing well, was Russo a part of that?
Not really. I think
that's your answer then, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there was... Definitely when the X Division started meaning like a whole lot less would have been around the time when Russo came in I believe it was late 06 and started like developing personalities for everyone, which developing personalities for everyone is actually a good thing to do if you know how to do it, because there was definitely an issue with some of the X Division guys, you kind of being a little bit bland and colorless, and you know they were kind of all being featured like in multi-man matches every month, just kind of being like thrown on the pay-per-view. It's like, well, we want to have an exciting match, and we have a bunch of guys that we want to get on the show, so let's do the 6-way ladder match or this, you know, 10-way cage match or, you know, this, you know, 4-way regular match or whatever, and. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only have so many of those before they all kind of run together. So, like, the X Division even then, you know, was kind of like in a little bit of a... It was in a little bit of a funk, but I think, you know, like, they had... You know, Jay Lethal was doing the Black Machismo thing, and they had, like, Sanjay Dutt, like, kind of... I don't know, he was... They kind of had him doing, like, a... Wasn't he doing like a guru gimmick or something? I don't really remember.
I think they were, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it was just like, you know, it wasn't, you know, like it's not good enough to be like a good worker, and even like, you know, just, you know, use your natural person, like a Daniel Bryan, like, you know, Daniel Bryan doesn't need a gimmick because Daniel Bryan's like an engaging guy and he can wrestle and he can get a crowd behind him. And, you know, there's not a lot of Daniel Bryans out there. I mean, he's obviously really great, but, you know, it's just like, there's a happy medium, I guess. You can, you know, you can feature a guy and let him talk and let him kind of show his personality, but you don't need to have like wacky storylines for everything. I mean, you can just have like,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can just have, like, good, fun, competitive matches, and if you put them, like, in the right context, and you, like, let them mean something, then you don't need, you know, you don't need all the other stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree. Or,
yeah.
Know, some guys have personality, some guys don't, some guys, you know, some guys can just get over on their charisma from the actual wrestling.
Right.
You know, they don't need to, you know, talk or say a whole lot to get over, you know, they're just,
yeah.
They're, facial expressions or just
yeah.
How they carry themselves.
I mean,
the rings could...
yeah. I mean, look at Samoa Joe. You know, when he first started, I mean, he was just, you know, he didn't talk that much. I mean, he was just, you know, he's this big ass kicker. And, you know, and obviously, you know, the X Division at its height was probably when he, you know, when he came along and you had, you know, you had Styles, you know, doing exciting stuff. You had that three-way with him and Christopher Daniels and AJ Styles. I mean, you had really strong workers. You had matches that were given time and that meant something on the show. And then it kind of devolved a little bit into kind of wacky randomness, and then it kind of went into silly stories, and now it's just kind of like, it's basically, it's a jobber belt, it's not really, it's not something that anyone really cares about. It's just sort of like, I don't know if there's an answer to that. I mean, for me, I would think maybe you just, you go back to having a cruiserweight belt, or you try to take the TV title and make it kind of the exciting, fun, I guess for lack of a better term, a work rate belt, and mm-hmm. which is kind of what the Intercontinental title was, for a long time in the 80s. I mean, it was the belt where the guys who, were really good, had great matches, and Hogan, did his thing with the world title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kind of doing something like that. I mean, maybe obviously they added, first it was the Legends title, then it was the Global title, and now it's the TV title. I mean, maybe, adding that belt probably diluted the X Division belt before, because mm-hmm. at least the X Division belt was like the only other title other than the world and tag titles.
Yeah. Now that's just, those are kind of, you kind of view those as almost one and the same.
Yeah, you just, so maybe, maybe unification might be a good idea. If you unify the TV and the X belt, or maybe if you drop them both and do a cruiserweight belt and just, let it be like smaller guys and not like mixing in the bigger guys, which I know worked with Joe and probably a couple other guys, but, probably at this point, it's just probably better to let the small guys, have their matches. But really, I mean, for it to really mean that much, you just need a fundamental change in philosophy, which, isn't going to happen unless you have, new people, behind the scenes, creatively running the company. And that appears like nothing is going to allow that to happen. So
you're exactly right. That's all these issues, 95% of it, comes down to, nothing's going to change and nothing's going to get better until there's, fundamental change in the creative team and who's in charge. So,
yeah. So, and I wouldn't hold my breath on that. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Oh, well. Well, there's plenty of great matches you can find on DVD or YouTube or whatever. Or so, I mean, and you got your work rate promotions like ROH and others that, still show that kind of style of wrestling a lot. And so if you're really like into the X Division style of stuff, I mean, there's other options. I mean, obviously people want it to be in TNA and, cause it used to be really known for that. And obviously it's more fun to watch stuff on a nice TV than it is, usually on a computer, unless you're able to mm-hmm. get a good DVD. But, there are at least other options where you can still, you can still find stuff like that, in mm-hmm. in the indies. And obviously, yeah, I mean, the X Division really did influence that indie style, which I'm not always crazy about, but it is fun and exciting at least a lot of the time. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, anything else?
No, I think this was fun. I always enjoy the Q&A's. So
yeah,
another fun one.
Cool. Yeah, and if you want to send us questions, you can always email us at WrestleSpective@gmail.com. You can also send us a message Facebook.com/WrestleSpective or Twitter.com/WrestleSpective. And we always appreciate getting feedback, any ideas, any comments or criticisms or what have you. You can also go to our website at WrestleSpective.com and you can leave us a comment on this podcast or anything else any other podcast or blog entry that we have. Also would love it if you check us out on iTunes and leave us a comment about the show there. We're always looking for that. So anyway, always appreciate everyone listening, and we will talk to you again.
No.